Working Cows Podcast, Episode 105.
Welcome to the podcast that gives producers a platform to discuss and share paradigm-challenging practices. Practices that have increased the effectiveness of their operation and the joy that their families have received from this lifestyle.
Hi, everybody. It's Clay Connery, host of the Working Cows Podcast. Really excited to be joined today by Graham Rees. Graham Rees is a member of KLR Marketing, three Australians applying the principles of Bud Williams and his marketing techniques and his low-stress stockmanship in Australia and teaching people there how to apply those principles on their ranch businesses as well. And Graham is fresh off of a tour of regenerative agriculture in the Northern Great Plains, and he has this is the second tour, and so we're going to talk with him today about his takeaways from that tour and some of the stuff that he learned and some of the stuff that we can learn along with them. So I'm really excited to be joined today by Graham Rees. Graham, thanks for joining me today on the Working Cows Podcast.
Hey, it's good to talk to you as well.
So recently you have completed a tour of the United States and some different ranches, mostly in the upper Midwest or upper Northern Great Plains, I guess, as I understand it. And this is the second tour that you've been on, I believe. So can you tell me a little bit about those tours and how they came about and what you've been ruminating on since they got over?
Well, thanks for inviting me. And, you know, I guess my story goes back quite a ways, and it's interesting where I'm sitting today in Dayton, because that's where my sort of journey in the US started. But my background is my wife and I used to run a 40,000 acre sheep station in Western New South Wales, and we loved doing that, enjoyed it, and in 1999. Bud Williams actually came and stayed with us for 4 days, and that changed everything in our lives to the point that, you know, we moved away for a period of time to educate our children, and in that time got involved teaching low-stress stockmanship schools. And then in 2003, Bud invited myself, Rod Knight, and Jim Lindsay to come over to Spokane, Washington, and attend his marketing school, because he believed that his marketing principles would work very well in Australia, and he wanted us to actually teach that out there. So we came over in 2003, attended that school, and you know, it was something that blew us away in terms of the possibilities for anybody in the livestock industry, and made us realize how much money we're leaving on the table, how we're focusing on the wrong things. But in order to be able to understand it more, we travel with Bud down to Bowie in Texas straight up, right after the school. And we did an 11-hour drive, and that 11-hour drive brought us to Dayton, where Padlock Ranch is. And interestingly, we went at the time of this call, we're staying in a little RV park in Dayton, so brings back a few memories. And then we drove on down to Texas and spent 3 weeks with Bud putting that school together. And it was during that drive, you know, that 30-odd-hour drive, that I saw things that just excited me. I mean, we didn't stop again. We just kept driving, and I wanted to come back and see more of the U.S., and we did that. My wife and I came back in 2012, 2013, and mainly fly fishing, but visiting a few ranches. And I realized that I wanted to share this with a few people. I'd met quite a lot of the people that are into regenerative agriculture. And so it came about because it just an idea. And last year's trip, we traveled from, we started in Dallas, Texas, and visited people like Walt Davis along the way, all the way up to northern Montana and finishing in Jackson. And on returning home, there was another group of people who said, well, what about next year? Are you going to take us? And so we planned something totally different this year, and we started in Salt Lake City, and we can go through who we visited and what we learned, and finished in Kansas City. But it was, something that both years were a trip in a lifetime. They're totally different, but it's like doing two trips in a lifetime in 2 years.
Can you tell me about some of the people who have joined you on these trips and kind of what their background in agriculture is?
Yeah, I think that's interesting in itself because it's the group that makes the tour. And whilst I haven't fully reviewed this year's tour, last year's tour we had 20 people plus Roz and myself, and we estimated there was 5,000 hours of conversation during that tour, both in the cars and around. We don't do this like a normal tour. It's not a bus. We hire five Suburbans, and so there's lots of chances for visiting in the car. You know, what was great is you'd visit somebody and then you might have a 3 or 4 hour drive to the next place. Well, you know, you can't hear everything, so everybody revisited the ranch. I heard this, I heard that, and people tightened up their notes, and it became it was something that happened both years. Is the groups started off, you know, some people knew each other, but most people didn't know each other. They had some things in common. They were mostly the marketing clients, part of our mastermind. And so they had that in common, but other than that, what they had in common was a quest for learning and knowledge. And, you know, some of them run quite big livestock operations, several thousand head of cattle in Australia. Some of them were quite young. I mean, last year we had an 18-year-old farmer and we had a 69-year-old farmer. And even in that in itself it was really interesting to hear those two in our car at one point sharing the enthusiasm of youth and the wisdom of age of what, you know, the things to look out for. So, quite a range of people. And, you know, actually last year we had a 13-year-old, one family brought their 13-year-old and their 11-year-old. And I still remember the 11-year-old, a rancher down in Texas said, "You're on quite the journey, young fella." And he said, "We're not on a journey, we're on a quest."
And what was the goal, I guess, starting out with these tours? What was the purpose? What did you have in mind?
Well, I know I'm referring back to last year, but I'll bring this year into context as well. And the only reason I keep referring back is I've had a lot of time to review last year. But when we came last year, Will Comiskey, who was one of the members, and I, we sat down and we said, so, you know, what is it that we want to cover? And we wanted to cover profitable regenerative agriculture and look at how ranchers and farmers look after grass, money and livestock. And when I say grass, I mean, you know, it can incorporate cropping. It's really plants and soil. Grass incorporates all of that. And it was as the journey went on, we realized it was more about the people. And when we got to Jackson last year, we went to the library and did a review, and we spent a few hours there. We put flip charts up and we said, we put up grass, money, livestock and people. And they had 5 minutes on each visit to fill out a little sticky note and put it up. Well, the people one was the fullest in terms of sticky notes. Now, interestingly, this year I did the same process when we're in Kansas City, and it was the same thing. The people one was the biggest. And so, you know, what I've come to realize is that regenerative agriculture is not necessarily about what someone does, because everybody has different approaches and everybody has different reasons for their approaches, but it's how they approach it and how they're thinking about it. And I think that Cooper Hibbard summed it up very well. He said, I don't want to think about what's not possible. I only want to think about what's possible. And if I look at all the people we've visited over the 2 years, that's how it's come about. I mean, you know, we visited Gabe Brown this year, and Gabe didn't know what he was doing when he started. He didn't know he was heading towards regenerative agriculture, but he just didn't think about what wouldn't work. And I think that's one of the challenges we have in agriculture in Australia and all over the world. In the US is, you know, culture is a huge thing here in the US, and I think culture is a great thing. But as long as it doesn't, you know, keep a business where it's not regenerative and not being profitable.
Yeah. You know, Gabe Brown's story is an interesting one. I've heard he's told it here on the podcast, and I've heard him speak in person, and he's shared the same story, is that, you know, when he started bale grazing, it was because he couldn't afford the twine to put on the bales that he was rolling up, you know, and so that was how he got started with it, and started to see the impact of it both on the pocketbook and on the soil health, and that really kind of set the ball rolling for him and changed the way he did a lot of different things. But you know, necessity is the mother of invention in some cases, and then also I really appreciate that. Don't think about what is impossible, only think about what's possible. And I think, like you said, our culture can box us in a lot of times. And I posted the other day on Twitter, I said, I wonder if I told people that you couldn't make that work here as a challenge before they told me that won't work here, if maybe that would spur them on to try something that has proven effective in other places in the world, you know, because in this part of the world anyways, if you challenge people and say, well, you can't do that, maybe they'd be more likely to try something before they could come up with reasons for themselves why it wouldn't work. But in any case, really appreciate that those goals that you guys had. It's interesting to me, the young man said, we're not on a journey, we're on a quest. And was there something that developed over time, over the course of the tour, that it became clear this is what this is about? You mentioned the people being the common theme in both tours, but are there things, recurring themes that came up in the tours that were very important to you, or very that stuck out to you?
Absolutely, and you know, I think this year's tour was in two elements really. It started with the ranching element, and more ranching and grazing, and so we started with a masterclass with Jim Gerrish out in Idaho, and a couple of days with Jim, which I'd always wanted to do one of his classes over the years, and because I think, you know, he has so much to add to the way we think about grazing, and so we spent those couple of days there looking at grazing management, and again, you know, grazing in high desert and using grazing management to change the environment. But what really highlighted to us was we visited the Alder Ranch grazing operation on the BLM. Jim took us up there and with Glenn, and you know, we drive right up in the mountains, and here's three herders living with the cattle, keeping them as a herd, allowing those cattle to graze areas once every 5 years, not allowing them on any riparian zone at all, even, you know, no riparian zones grazed. They put electric fence down to a water so they can go in and get a drink. And, you know, there's a whole story about that, you know, and what's possible, because, I mean, they're in country where there's grizzlies and wolves and mountain lion, and they're growing grass-fed meat and marketing that, the whole chain. And so I thought that was exciting. They're grazing 500 species out of 2,500 species, and actually Fred Pervenz is doing some work with them looking at the phytochemicals of the product. So I thought that was that was great. But then the theme kind of continued because we left there and we went to J-Bar-L Ranch, where a lady called Peggy owns that ranch, and her goal is really to have a ranch that interfaces domestic livestock with wildlife. Andrew, the manager, and his wife Hillary, she's one of the great experts on wolves, and she's worked a lot with the herders getting the cattle herding, and spoke about the success they've had where wolves have actually walked right past their cattle to kill neighbours' cattle. So it was, you know, there was again was that interface with nature and domestic livestock, and again showed what's possible. And we left there, and we visited with John Helly from Duckworth Ranch, and he took us over their summer range, which we were at 9,000 feet, and we pulled up, and he said, "Let's walk across over this ridge," and we walked over a ridge, and there is a herd of sheep grazing down from us, and we just stood there, 22 of us. And this herd of sheep grazed right up within 20 feet of us, formed around us and kept on grazing, didn't stop. And, it, you know, again, you know, that's in an environment that's very harsh. I mean, one of his guard dogs had been killed by a grizzly 2 days before. So it's not easy. But, again, you know, they're doing something that's possible. And, it, you know, at 9,500 feet, to go to a pristine landscape like that was just huge. So I thought that was, you know, to me that was a highlight, I suppose, coming from a sheep station in Australia and seeing that and how they do that was amazing. And then the other part of the first few days was stockmanship. So Steve Cody, who's actually just written a book on stockmanship. I'd met Steve here at Padlock back in 2003 and visited with him outside the motel for a few hours and then made acquaintance with him again last year. And he came up and talked to the group about stockmanship. And then when we visited the Seaburn Ranch, Witibard and Dawn, who Dawn had worked with Bud for 10 years in the feedlot in Canada, so, you know, had a huge amount of experience. So we certainly learned a lot about stockmanship. I thought the interesting thing for me, you know, as somebody who teaches stockmanship, we were having conversations about we don't know where the level is. And I run across a lot of people who say, oh, yeah, I do low-stress stockmanship and kind of, you know, they think they've achieved those levels. Yet there's four of us actually having that discussion about, well, you know, we don't know where the possibilities are, where the level is. And I remember talking to Bud 2 months before he died, and I said, "Why are you still doing this stuff, Bud?" And he said, "I'm still trying to figure it out. It's not easy."
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Lifelong learning is a theme of people who, I think, operate at a high level, is that they recognize that they haven't got it all figured out for sure. And to see people that are operating at that level, trying new things and different things, and that is pretty incredible. What stuck out to you about the herding aspect of those places that you were on?
Well, I think that the thing that stuck out for me is their ability to be able to, especially the cattle on the older ranch, those herders are not actually moving the cattle or herding the cattle as such. They're more there to protect the cattle and make sure they stay as a herd. But those cattle, as long as they don't graze an area, they use GPS, an area within 5 years, they can pretty much determine where they want to go. And I thought what struck me interestingly, you know, we don't have high country in Australia, is how spring doesn't last 60 days. Spring lasts 4 months, because as those higher altitudes come in, they they come into spring much later, and so as they follow up in the higher altitudes, they're able to do that. So one of the things that struck me is they had not known of any beavers within 100 miles of that region. And today, there's beavers building beaver dams right up through those riparian zones, and in fact, the riders saw, before the beavers started building dams, they actually saw beavers walking across the range to come into that area. So how does that happen? You know, how did the beavers know that now it's they're needed to repair that riparian zone? I thought that was, I wish we had beavers in Australia, because they just do such a huge job in water management. Mm. But I think as Steve Cody pointed out, a lot of people on BLM land are under a lot of pressure to keep their cattle off the riparian zones. And, you know, he gave an example of, you know, sometimes it can take a ranch a dozen riders to keep those cattle every day moved off the riparian zones, when in fact, with some really good rider training that Steve and Rick run, one or two riders can just park that herd and they'll stay in an area and do that easily. They'll go down, drink at the creek, and go back up to the hill. So I think that was, you know, to see that in action and see it working, I thought that was fantastic.
Do you think that herding is the future? I mean, that sounds really weird to say, but in America, it hasn't made it here yet. Do you think it's the future of kind of managing those vast expanses of Western land in America?
Oh, look, probably not, because I don't think many people would commit to do the work. And, Steve Cody made the point. He said, you know, a rider that has those skills doesn't get paid any more than any other rider.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't think that change is going to happen quickly. I think that was something that is always hard when you bring a group over here, is that, you know, there's tradition and then there's people pushing the boundaries. And I guess, you know, when you take a group and you visit everybody pushing the boundaries, they think, they can tend to think, oh, that's how everyone does it. But, you know, I did get to visit a ranch that was traditional, which gave them quite a shock on things like, you know, every ranch we visit, every farm we visit, they try and work closely with what nature provides. So they don't try and carve in the middle of winter, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, you know, they're not trying to manipulate nature. They're working with nature. And when you work with nature, then you can be rewarded quite well by nature. You know, this year probably was a good example. You know, winter went on until summer.
Mm.
And, I'm sure, you know, that was a tough winter for a lot of people. But, those people that just work with nature, you know, they had later calving and, really managing their grazing can make a huge impact. I mean, we saw some grazing country in northern Montana that's been taken from 15 grazing days per acre to 96 grazing days per acre. And it wasn't any big thing, you know, for them. It was just something that they did. And, I think that was what was good for us, is Roland Cruz, who's a holistic trainer based in Bozeman. We met him last year, but he came with us for 4 days this year, and it was just great to have a local that had the expertise to, you know, keep giving us the context of things. It was quite amazing to see, you know, how important, for instance, he says monitoring is, and certainly the ranches that he works with re-emphasize that.
We could talk about this trip all day. I know we could, but I guess there were two. Where did you go? I know you did. You finish up in South Dakota. Were there more tours to the south that you guys did once you?
Yep. So we kind of finished the I suppose the livestock side of things at we went to the Flying D and to go through the gate and see 5,000. Bison there in a mob, and to hear the story that Ted Turner took a painting to the ranch manager and said, this is what I want you to create, you know, and they did. And again, it's, you know, if someone took that to a normal person, they go, that's not possible, that's a painting. But they did. We went, we had a brief couple of days at the Ranching for Profit conference, put on by ranch management consultants, and so we, that was kind of a transition to more soil and plants. We had Nicole Masters there, who's certainly opened a lot of people's eyes, and then we really transitioned more into the cropping and the soils. We visited Gabe Brown. I mean, Gabe's story is documented over and over, but to go there and have him show us some soils from different workings was huge. And the Manukan Farms, they did a great job of showing us about erosion and about water infiltration. But from there, we went down to Dr. Jonathan Lundgren, and I guess Jonathan was a real highlight for me. He blew me away in, you know, he's an entomologist who kind of got the phone call from the USDA and no longer works there. And so he set up Blue Dasher Farms to basically show, again, what's possible with insects and how predator insects can control your insects. I mean, he just laid it out for us that, you know, nature provides. And he talked about instances where areas they spray insects, they get more insects, and areas where they don't spray them, the predators just seem to be keeping them out and not having problems. He showed us, and now I can't remember the name of it, but he showed us a grain variety plant that he's growing there. He said, would I grow this at $17 a pound, or would I grow corn at $3 a bushel? You tell me. But he was, his enthusiasm and excitement to show us, and it just opened up, I think, everybody's eyes to, again, what's possible and how insects can not be a bad thing for our crops and our animals, but actually can be a good thing as well. And then we went down, we visited with Doug Ferguson, and Doug, he does a blog, each week, and he's probably one of the most well-known marketers using Bud's marketing principles in the U.S. down at Beatrice and Beatrice, and so Doug really just showed us how it works here and how he does that. And from Doug, we kept on the cropping and the cover cropping scale. So we visited with Dale Strickler in Cortland, Kansas, Michael Thompson, who if you haven't interviewed Michael, we met him last year, and Michael came across specially to give us a presentation. He's in Western Kansas, and his story is quite amazing, how he's shifted his farm from traditional to a very regenerative farm. Incidentally, one of the things that Jonathan Lundgren said is, how you're running a regenerative farm, well, are you making a profit every year? Because if you're not making a profit every year, you're not running a regenerative farm. And we finished up with visiting Gail Fuller and Darren Williams. And so Gail Fuller, you know, he told us one of the stories he told us. He said, you know, in Kansas has the ability to grow 15% of the world's food, yet Kansas imports 90% of their own food. And so I thought that was remarkable. And then we finished in Kansas City with Eunice Williams, Bud's wife, and Tina and his daughter and Richard. That was a great way to round out the tour. It was certainly something else. And I think a reoccurring theme that for me was, I heard something spoken by somebody before I left, and it just kept coming back to me through the tour, is every organism on the planet relies on an ecosystem, yet it seems to be humans that think they only rely on a financial system.
Very true. We get too focused on the ones and zeros and forget that we're part of a world that is feeding us indeed. So I really appreciated that. I was hoping we would get to Jonathan Lundgren. He's a guy that is on my radar for sure, and you've mentioned a few other names that I'm writing down here. So look forward to contacting some of these people and getting in touch with them. I would like to finish up with just the what can Americans learn from Australians, and what can Australians learn from Americans? Is there anything that sticks out in that regard?
Well, I think both groups, both Americans and Australians, can learn. You know, one of the things I identified is everything's very fragmented. You know, most of the people we visited, a lot of them had never even heard of the people we visited in their own country.
Hmm.
And I realise that's the same in Australia. So I think the thing that the two groups did is they took a risk and spent some money and some time to go and learn. And just remember, these Australians, you know, the fellow that brought his family last year, he's in his seventh year of drought. Hmm. 75% of both groups are in drought. And I mean, not drought like you get here, severe drought, nothing, just right. Bare. And mostly destocked. And so, you know, it'd be very easy to say, look, you know, I can't afford it. It's going to be money out of my budget that I don't have. But to a man and a woman, they all said, this is so important for us in our recovery. We need it. And more so as they went. You know, many times both years I heard people as they left the ranch, that ranch visit alone was worth the cost of the trip.
Mm.
And, you know, money's one thing, but to take 3 weeks away from your farm or your ranch, I think is incredible. Now, Australians travel a lot, so that's not unusual, but, you know, I'm still here because we stayed on doing some fly fishing. We're sitting on 6,000 miles. That's more. We've seen more states. We've seen more states than most Americans have seen in their lifetime in 6 weeks. and so I think it's. I think what people can learn is you know what I would say to the Americans is you've got to leave. You've got to leave your own community and your own area and your own paradigm and go and look for new paradigms. Go and look for new ideas and new thoughts because. Don't be judgmental. Just go and listen and learn. And again, you know, what could be possible that you could bring back in your environment? You know, and I suppose that's one of the things that excited me the most is to see last year's group go back. And, you know, here we are 12 months later. They've implemented a huge amount of what they learned. And, it's quite exciting to see them doing all the various different things that they're implementing on their own ranches. I think one of the things that probably puts a burr under my blanket at the moment is, you know, having worked with Bud and livestock marketing is to see the conversation going on at the moment about, beef prices and they're too low and we need better beef prices and it's because of imported beef or it's because of something else or tariffs or whatever it is. And I think, you know, one of the things that I talk about is when we're in the commodity market, we are price takers and we shouldn't be focused on those things. We've got to focus on the things we can focus on in our business and that's our costs. But Doug Ferguson put a great post up this week really talking about you know, while everyone's complaining about the price has come down, yet the margins are bigger. And so I think both in Australia and in the US, right around the world, you know, tradition keeps us where we're at and we always are looking outside our circle we're looking at the circle of concern, the area that we have no control over. I mean, we have no control over what, you know, export markets do, import markets do, what governments do, but we have control over what happens on our ranch, and that happens between our ears, And if something's not working on your ranch, it's the guy in the mirror that you look at every morning that's responsible.
Absolutely. So as we transition to letting you talk a little bit about some things you've got going on, could you talk a little bit about how KLR marketing has helped people who are facing a seventh year of drought?
Yeah, look, I think that's sometimes you know, we had no idea the impact that we'd have teaching that school. And we started teaching it in 2004, and it wasn't very long before we put together a mastermind group. And, you know, that's made up of lots of tools and coaching and mentoring, because it is a huge paradigm shift to think sell by marketing, because it's much more than that. It's about, you know, the first principle is balancing grass, money, and livestock. You know, often people talk about they're a rancher and they run cattle. Well, no, they're actually just grass growers. And how you sell that grass through the animals you own is going to determine whether you're profitable or not. And so what's really helped those people is to understand the cost of keeping those animals and taking them forward in a drought. As they've, you know, they're using the ranching for profit principles, you know, matching stocking rate to carrying capacity. And so they're using those, but then using the tools and the principles to understand that, you know, if I destock, then I'm buying grass for the animals I'm keeping. I'm actually putting the money over here for when it rains again. And so as they go through that process, being able to sit down and do the math on, you know, should I feed these livestock or should I sell them and replace them? You sell them and just replace them with money in the bank. You know, a story is story after story after story in Australia of people that have been in those droughts, whether it be 2 years, 3 years, or seven, is they just put their head down and go, no, I'm going to feed my stock until it rains. And, you know, suddenly it's $100,000, $200,000, $1 million, $2 million, $3 million of feed going down the livestock. At some point, you know, you run out of grass, so then you use money to go and buy the hay and grain, and then you run out of money. Now you're basically selling livestock at a low price. Probably a good example is I manage a place for a fellow, and I do his marketing. And the last three winters, we've been totally destocked. And being able to determine that if we're not going to feed any animals, if we've got no grass to move animals up a grade, then we sell what we've got and we won't replace. We'll just put that money in the bank. And then when we have feed, we'll just go to the market and we'll buy underpriced livestock and we'll move them up a grade. And we've done that 3 years in a row. I think, you know, it's just so relaxing not to be having conversations about the weather or the prices. I mean, if you go out and talk to any rancher or any farmer, they want to talk about prices and they want to talk about when it's going to rain. You know, it's no point in worrying about that stuff because we have no control over it.
Absolutely. So could you talk a little bit about your mastermind and what you've been doing with that?
Yeah, so the school goes for 2.5 days, and we teach that. We are endeavoring to bring it to the U.S. Next year, just trying to satisfy a lot of requirements to be able to do that in another country. But after, it's like anything, the paradigm shift is so big that you need coaching and mentoring along the way, and we've got a lot of tools there to help people be able to do those calculations. We've got a lot of a network of support. You know, for instance, what's happened in the drought is the people that have destocked have been almost pushed away from their community. Like, well, you know, we're saving the industry while you destock, and you're just going to sit by and wait for us to feed all their stock, and then you'll come and buy them. And so to have them network with people with the same mindset has been huge for for people. And so, you know, we run coaching, mentoring days. I do a teleconference every Wednesday night where we have a discussion call and people can ask questions. And then, of course, you know, people had an opportunity to go on a trip like this. And so I think in anything, when you're learning something new, you need that support because, you know, when you go back home, somebody's going to say, whether it be grandpa, whether it be somebody else in the business, or whether it be the sale barn guy or the agent, they're going to go, no, that won't work. And all of a sudden you're doubting yourself. And so we find ourselves supporting those people. Extraordinary stories of what people have achieved and why have those people survived so well in the drought? Well, you know, part of it's planning, but the other part is when you run out of resources, you get resourceful. And a lot of people have done extraordinary things to keep cash flow going and keep income coming in the door.
Yeah, absolutely. Very good stuff. And one more thing that I can think of is your Regen Ag Book Club. Is that a group that's still taking new members?
Yeah, so the Regen Ag Book Club, it didn't start as anything to do with me, really. It started last year. Charlotte Bronson, who was on the trip, she started the group. And in a conversation with her, I said, you know, well, it's doing a book is one thing, but why not interview the authors? And because that's, you know, I do a similar type podcast from the mastermind to you. And so I got involved with her helping her do the interviews. And anyway, she's actually left agriculture and she's becoming a paramedic. So she's deep in studies. And so I kind of adopted a lot of that group. But we're going to, yeah, the Regen Ag Book Club, it's no big deal. People can join it on Facebook. We'll have a book every month or 2 months. I've taken a break while we're on this trip, but we'll be right back at it because there's a lot of books to come. And the ability to hear, not everybody can get everything out of a book. So the ability to read the book, ask questions on those calls. And it's kind of just a hobby for me. It's kind of a passion to be able to interview those people and exciting. And so I've got the previous interviews are stored in a free membership area. People can go to regenagbookclub.com and just join and listen to those interviews. So I don't know where it'll go or what Charlotte wants to do with it, but I'm going to keep it. It's too good to let it go, so I'll keep it going. If people want to know more about KLR Marketing, klrmarketing.com.au is our website, and there's the ability to get a podcast there about a lot deeper in what we talk about. And, you know, a lot of people think it's all about just trading. And whereas, you know, we spend half of the second day talking about cow-calf operations, how to run a profitable cow-calf operation. And I think, you know, that's something that, people often struggle to be able to do.
So I opened up questions from my private Facebook group, and Shannon Sims tells me that I have to get you to tell the Dallas Mount Deer story. Do you know what he's talking about?
we were coming back from actually out visiting the Sims Ranch, and I have a rule: no driving at night, and because we smash up a car, we're done. And so, but just happened to be we were driving back from having supper back into Wheatland, and as we're driving along, Dallas has done the marketing school in Australia and spent quite a bit of time with me and Jim and Rod with some of our clients and mastermind days, and so as we were driving along, we were talking about marketing, and there's a, you know, when we talk about animals, we're talking about either underpriced or overpriced. They're never cheap or dear. And so as we're talking away, you know, we're talking about this marketing deal that someone was doing, and he said he lost money and Dallas said deer, and I said, you mean underpriced? He said, no, a deer, stop.
Nice.
Because we our deer are kangaroos, but it was just so funny. Because I was just correcting you. No,
right.
You mean underpriced. No.
Nice. I like it. Very good. Well, Graham, thank you for your time today. Anything else you wanted to share? Anything we left on the table here today?
Thanks for inviting me. Look, I would invite anybody to connect with me. I love connecting with people and sharing stories. We did a book on last year's trip. I haven't decided whether that's going to be released publicly or not. It's been given to the people we visited and the groups, but if we do decide to do that, then that may be available. It's 142 pages of pure information from about the people we visited, and so that may be something people are interested in. I'm always happy to connect with people and share, and I just encourage people to just make a trip somewhere. Doesn't matter, come down to Australia. Americans seem to think it's a long way. It's two movies and a sleep. Get on a plane, come down. We'll host you. We'll look after you. We'll show you some things that, will open your eyes. But thanks for the opportunity to chat with you today.
Very good. And I would encourage people to reach out to Graham and get in touch with him and let him know that you would like, that there is interest in the book, because that sounds like a great resource to me. So I really look forward to future opportunities to connect. And I thank you again for your time.
All right, thanks, Clay.
Really enjoyed the opportunity to sit down with him. A lot of wisdom there, a lot of perspective from different areas of the world. And I would encourage you to check out show notes page at workingcows.net/105, workingcows.net/105 for links to some of the stuff that we discussed today, and a way to get a hold of Graham and just learn a little bit more about his ideas and what he's teaching. So coming up next week, I'm really excited. I've got a grazer named Alex. This is what we're going to call him, from China, and we're going to talk to him about Chinese agriculture and how he is applying some out-of-the-box principles to a very, very challenging environment. So I look forward to episode 106 next week on the Working Cows Podcast.
We invite you to visit workingcows.net to subscribe to the show via iTunes or Stitcher. You'll also find detailed show notes pages, resources from our guests, and the industry leaders who have influenced them. For more ideas on putting your cows to work for you in a more profitable way, tune in next week.